order the September 2nd, 2021 meeting of the TPA's Bicycle Trailways Pedestrian Advisory Committee. The Palm Beach TPA is conducting this meeting both in person and virtually using a Zoom webinar platform. Instructions to join the virtual meeting as well as contact information for assistance are provided in the published meeting agenda. Staff, please call the roll so we can establish a quorum.
Good morning, everyone. I want to remind you to unmute your microphones by either pushing the button on the base or if you are virtual to unmute on your computer. My staff will also be able to assist you if needed. Alternates, please also state your name if you are attending on behalf of a BTPAC representative. Tracy Phelps. Tracy, I'm sorry. I don't think your microphone's on. Or you need to bring it closer.
You should see a red dot when it turns on.
So the top of the microphone should be red.
Give us a second, everybody.
Okay, present.
Thank you. Bruce Rosenzweig.
Present.
Craig Pinder.
Kathleen Hatcher, alternate. Present.
Thank you, Kathleen. Ted Goodenough.
Present.
Joanna Peluso.
Present.
Joanne Scaria. I believe she was going to be absent from this meeting. I will have to check my notes. Fadi Nassar.
Present.
Sally Channon.
Here.
David Willock.
Here.
Jean Matthews.
Here.
Yash Nagal. Michael Owens.
I am in attendance.
John Roach.
Present.
Ryan Harding.
Christian Santa, alternate for Brian Harding.
Larry Wallace.
Good morning, everyone.
Brian Ruscher.
Present.
And Stephanie Thoburn is excused. We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Margie. Are there any modifications to the agenda?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay. Do I need a motion to approve the agenda or can we go right to the minutes?
You can go right to the minutes.
Thank you. So I need a motion to approve the minutes for July 8th. Are there any changes? If not, I'll accept the motion.
A motion to approve the minutes for July 8th, 2021 from Michael Owens.
Good enough, second.
There were lots of people speaking. Who was that seconded?
I had Ted Goodenough as a seconder.
Thank you. I have a motion by Michael and a second by Ted. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed, say aye. Nay. Okay, thank you. Now on to general public comments and public comments on agenda items. As a reminder for anybody, there are three ways to provide public comment for this meeting. Written comments may be submitted online at the website provided in the agenda. Verbal comments may be provided by a virtual attendee using the raise hand feature in the Zoom platform. Verbal and written comments may be provided by an in-person attendee submitting a comment card available at the welcome table. Staff, are there any public comments?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. And just as a reminder, if you are not speaking, please mute your microphones. We get the feedback throughout the TPA office. Thank you. At this time, I want to invite any BTPAC member comments on items not already on the agenda. For members participating remotely, please raise your hand in the Zoom platform and then remember to unmute your microphone once you're recognized. So in the room, I have Sally. Are there any hands raised?
I do not have any virtual hands raised.
Thank you. Sally, the floor is yours.
Okay. Sorry about that. At the July meeting, I had asked about if we could get some information on what was going on with North Palm Beach, because they had been involved in that. They were pulling back from a bunch of things and not going forward with requests for TA funding on the project. They'd had this kind of long-term thing, first with the Regional Planning Council doing a whole design charrette and all of that for that US 1 corridor. And then they've just pulled back. They withdrew their application, this past year's application, and then have pulled out of some additional study. And I apologize if the email response, I was supposed to get some follow-up on that because there wasn't nobody in the room at that time knew. But I didn't see any response. Is there an update on like what's going on? I'm just interested in what happens with these communities when they start with these plans to, you know, like do a sort of a redo of their community to make it more completely transportation accessible, and then just start, you know, dropping out.
So like Andrew can talk on that. I am going to check my email and see why that email did not go out though, but Andrew's going to talk on that for a second.
Good morning. This is Andrew Euler, Palm Beach CPA, Deputy Director of Program Development. Sorry, Sally, that we haven't provided that yet to you. But I can give you a quick update. We actually had a meeting recently with North Palm Beach regarding that section of US 1. So this is a project that is, they're looking to do a land repurposing. And so the town is, or North Palm Beach is still considering that as an option. And so we're still trying to finalize a typical section for that entire stretch. And then we're going to have our regional planning agency go in and present again to their council to get their feedback on that. And then that would then be something that we would potentially put back into our list of priority projects once we have a verified typical section. I could tell you just a little small note inside here too, is that it sounds like from their council meetings that they wanted to have a typical section, and then they wanted to go to the voters with that typical section to get their approval. So this might actually be a longer process than we were hoping for, but regardless, we're still moving forward, and we can send out an email with more details specifically on that.
Okay, thank you. I'm glad to know that it isn't just that it's somehow, you know, been.
Yep, there's been a lot of back and forth with North Palm Beach, with FDOT and us, and the Regional Planning Council regarding the typical section, and it's been going back and forth with FDOT on the review of that. So it's been taking a while to finalize that typical section, but it looks like land repurposing is still the option moving forward right now.
Thank you.
Any other comments from this BITPAC members? Seeing none, I'll just make a couple of quick comments. In October, the City of Delray Beach intends to proclaim National Community Planning Month. And in doing so, we're going to have a couple of different celebrations and educational events. We've been very successful in receiving grants from the Florida Division of Historic Preservation to study Atlantic Avenue's corridor and historic assets. So we'll be celebrating that along with going to various schools and celebrating by educating high school students during that month, a couple of different class sessions, and also celebrating National Bike or Walk Your Child to School Day, which is, I believe, October 6th. I'm not sure if I saw that on the liaison's report, but we'll be proclaiming that as well. We're going to get our fire department, police department out, I think, to two different schools this year. And we've had participation in the numbers of a couple of hundred kids walking on those days. It's a really great event. And I'd encourage all the municipalities to do similar style event programming. So that's my comments. Liaison's report. Alyssa, do you want to give us a liaison report?
Sure. It'll be up on the screen in a second. There we go. So I guess before I dive into this, yes, to confirm, Walk to School Day or is October 6th, and we will be doing something with the school district and encouraging all of our municipalities and the schools to host something. But on to our liaison's report. So bicycle-friendly designations, the bicycle-friendly business designation is offered through the League of American Cyclists and is based on the belief that bicycles are good for businesses, employees, and the community. Applications for the bicycle-friendly business program are due by October 5th, and more information is available on their website, bikeleague.org/BFA. The Okeechobee Boulevard and State Road 7 multimodal corridor study, we are offering a virtual public workshop to provide input on transportation issues and opportunities along Okeechobee and State Road 7. This workshop will provide the public an opportunity to learn more about the study and provide feedback on how we can plan for a more safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. We have more information on this on our website at palmbeachtpa.org/okey. The Transportation Disadvantaged Local Coordinating Board is seeking board members. The LCB focuses on the needs of Palm Beach County's transportation disadvantaged population, specifically older adults, persons with disabilities, low income, and children at risk. The LCB is seeking members for the roles of representative of children at risk and representative for the elderly. And for more information or to apply, please reach out to Kelsey Peterson at our office. Her email address is kpeterson@palmbeachtpa.org, and she is the liaison for that board and will help you out with that. The Everyday Counts Safety Summit Series, Federal Highway Administration is hosting a safety webinar every Wednesday throughout the month of September. The summit series will highlight 7 safety initiatives and share how they can save lives. For more information and to register, visit palmbeachtpa.org/everydaycounts. The September TPA Governing Board meeting will be held on September 16th at 9 a.m., both in person and virtually. To view the agenda packet and meeting details, please visit our website, palmbeachtpa.org/board. An FDOT Transplax webinar safety series. FDOT is hosting a web safety series every Friday throughout the month of October. The safety web series is focused on the elements of the safe system approach to eliminating fatalities and serious injuries on our roadways. To view the full calendar of sessions and to register, visit fdot.gov/planning/transplax. High visibility enforcement funding became available on July 1st. And for more information or to apply, visit alerttodayflorida.com/HVE. And again, that's for pedestrian and bicycle high visibility enforcement funding. And then lastly, we have the TPA has completed a complete streets video that showcases roadways in Palm Beach County that are designed to enable safe access for all users, including pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists, and transit riders. For more information on complete streets and to watch the video, please visit our website, palmbeachtpa.org/complete streets. But we're also going to show you the video right now. So enjoy.
The Palm Beach Transportation Planning Agency, or TPA for short, plans, prioritizes, and funds transportation projects in Palm Beach County. The TPA's vision is a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. One of the ways to achieve this vision is through complete streets. Complete streets are designed for users of all ages and abilities, including transit riders, bicyclists, and pedestrians. Let's hear about some of the complete streets projects across Palm Beach County and Florida.
US 1, a federal highway, which was a highway that was running through our downtown, high speeds, lots of accident history. It was a natural blockade for pedestrians. They would stop and not want to cross a 4-lane highway with cars speeding by.
This is Okeechobee Boulevard. It is designed for fast moving vehicles to go in and out of the city. And that's not necessarily what the values of the city has or the citizen of the city has.
This is an old town. We have been established for 70 years. And this road, US 1, has been there for a lot longer than that. We didn't have decorative lighting. We had very narrow sidewalks up there.
What is the root cause of why our streets are so unsafe? And it comes down to how we design it. And we design it for cars, and we design it for speed.
When I hear from friends and relatives who live elsewhere in the country or in the state, and they see the activities that we're doing to create an environment that is welcoming for everyone, for people in vehicles, for pedestrians, and for cyclists, they want to move here. And we want to make sure that everyone feels safe and welcome here.
We were notified by the Florida Department of Transportation that they were going to come in and simply repave a 6-lane stretch of US Highway 1. And we thought we would take advantage of that time to be able to look at something that would be bicycle friendly, pedestrian friendly. The concern was it's different. It's changing. I've always been able to have 6 lanes on this highway. It wasn't so much that it was a bad idea. It just wasn't something they expected or wanted. And that was until we got this project really done.
Well, it was about 6 years ago when the city of Del Reach reached out to the school and let us know that this was an improvement that they were considering. We spoke about it with our SAC members, our community stakeholders, who also had concerns about the safety of students coming and going. Everyone was 100% in favor of it.
We had an engineering firm come in and take out a lane with little barriers that didn't look so good for about a year to study the traffic impact. And what we learned was we were able to slow speeds by between 6 and 10 miles an hour, depending where you were on the corridor. The accident history on the study area went down 50%, which is extremely significant. And at the intersection of US 1 and Atlantic Avenue, we saw a 75% reduction in traffic accidents.
The great thing about living around here, at least on Cumberland, is that when I do go out for a bike ride, I am safe. I have what some people might call armadillos along the road that separate the bike lane from the car lane. It really does add a layer of protection for the biker.
We said, you know, it's not good business to have people driving 65 miles an hour past your main street. We have to slow it down, which is good for the economy. Once the narrowing came in and the bike lanes were added and the landscaping was added, people start to see what it could be. So the potential takes over. And what we did is we turned a highway into a neighborhood.
There are less parents driving because the kids that live closer are now able to walk. So it's offloaded the number of cars that are coming and going in the afternoon.
So by interconnecting the roadways for bicyclists and vehicles and pedestrians, it gives all residents the ability to have access to resources in the neighborhood, such as medical resources, job opportunities, educational opportunities, and that's what we want.
But I truly believe that if we work together and that we all know what the end goal is, that we can get there.
As we've seen, complete streets can help create a safe, efficient, and connected multimodal transportation system. The TPA looks forward to working with local municipalities to implement complete streets projects across Palm Beach County. To learn more, go to palmbeachtpa.org/complete streets.
Thank you for the video. Are there any comments on the report? Public comments? Any comments from the
community? I haven't received any public comments, and I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Thank you. And it looks like Sally's got her placard up.
It's a very nice video. I thought it was great when they gave a statistic about the decrease in that accident rate on the road. And it would be really wonderful if there were a statistic for the decrease in traffic at the schools, because that's a that's a big thing that affects congestion for, you know, for everybody and for everybody that drives. It's really noticeable when school's in session and you have the big drop off in the school zone, but very nicely done.
Thank you, Sally. Mayor and former Mayor Perlman does a really good job with advocating for that project in Delray. It's a really, really earth-shattering project for Delray Beach when it happens. So I could, and I agree about the school comment. We have other zones which are difficult. So,
Brian, right, I do have Ted with his hand raised.
And let's let Ted go, and then we'll.
I'm just wondering, is the, in that video, is there a American Sign Language interpreter on the video? Because closed captioning is great, but it's kind of like, oh, well, I was watching this video and I got to read the things. And sign language interpreters actually can give the enthusiasm of the speakers. And so that's A, and B, why is there not audio description on it so that somebody who can't see can understand what's in the background?
Thank you, Ted. So right now we do not have an ASL interpreter for this video, but that's definitely something I can talk to the RPR team about, incorporating both an audio description and an ASL interpreter. And we can see, you know, what's possible to improve this moving forward.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Jean?
I was just going to say, I was a resident while this US 1 lane reduction was going through, and I knew Mayor Perlman, and there was a lot of feedback from Delray residents who didn't want it. And then when it was done, they were like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever. Like, it really, the pushback was so strong from the residents, but once it was completed, they were thrilled. So sometimes you just push ahead.
Thank you, Jean. Now onto action items 2A. We're going to have Jason Price, TPA TIP coordinator, to present this item.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Stop screaming.
So today I'll be presenting the first amendment to the Transportation Improvement Program for fiscal year 2022 to 2026. And as a reminder to the group that this is an action item that will require a vote at the end of the presentation and discussion. So to begin, just to describe what the roll forward is, this is the rolling forward of funds from fiscal year 2021 in our previous TIP document, and rolling those funds forward into fiscal year 22, the first year in the new adopted TIP, the TIP that was adopted in June. And so with this particular roll forward amendment, which is typically the first amendment of the season of all of the amendments, this roll forward is an effort to keep consistent the projects in the Transportation Improvement Program and the FDOT's work program. So by moving this money forward, both of these documents for the FDOT, which is they're managing their projects through the STIP document, and we have a TIP document, and this roll forward keeps them consistent with the funding. And the funding is moved forward by each individual project and within the phases within those projects. So none of the money is being moved between projects or between phases. And in total for this amendment, there's a total of 67 projects for $39 million being moved from the previous TIP into this, into the new TIP. Can you advance the slide, please? I think the this is out of battery. So with all amendments, to the Transportation Improvement Program, there's specific things that trigger an amendment, and those are listed here on the screen. The first is when a project is either added or deleted from the Transportation Improvement Program, as well as if there's a cost increase of more than 20% and $2 million, or if there's a scope change in scope for the project where the length changes by a half mile and is and 20% of the project, or there's a change in the total number of traffic lanes. Now the next three slides, I'll give you a snapshot of the largest the projects with the largest amount of roll forward funds going from the previous TIP and being rolled into this new TIP. And that can be identified by the three columns to the right here. The first column is the current TIP document that was approved in June that has the current amount. And then the next column has the amount being rolled forward that will be incorporated after this amendment is approved and adopted. There'll be those additional funds will be represented in the new TIP, which is the third column to the far right. And you can see these are the top four projects that have the highest amount being rolled forward. These are in descending order, a few more of the projects. And in total, on the last here, on the last page here, there's a total of about a dozen projects. And the cutoff point for what I'm illustrating here is about 500,000 in roll forward funds. And this is simply just to keep the projects consistent with the STIP document that's managed by the FDOT and brings it in conformity or consistency, being consistent with the Transportation Improvement Program managed by the TPA. So with that, I'll conclude my presentation and I'll ask for a motion to recommend adoption of amendment number one.
Are there any public comments on the item?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay, is there any board discussion? Looks like Jean.
Oh, there I go. I have one brief question. Where's the Palm Beach County North Transit facility and what is it? Curiosity.
Yes. They're basically moving forward with construction of building out their northern layover facility. I think it's just north of Mangonia Park. So they've been working on that for several years now, and then they're just adding on. There's a lot of additional add-ons from what I remember from the TAC presentation we had. Anna from PalmTran describe all the additional facilities or add-ons that were being incorporated into that layover facility that's being constructed.
Thank you.
Any hands raised?
I have John Roach.
John?
Morning. Just want to clarify, I think you had it in your slides, but our vote is purely on the projects that are listed in the amendment, correct? And not.
Yes, it was on the slide. I failed to mention that part, that only the projects that are listed in the roll forward amendment are the projects that would be impacted. So no other project within the TIP document will be impacted by this roll forward. My apologies for not mentioning that part as part of the slide.
No, it's okay. It's just, you know, as with previous amendments, you know, we obviously want to clarify that our vote in support of the amendments is purely for those projects that are contained within there and not the, some of the other projects that are in the TIP. So thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else? Looks like Jean.
No, I just want to make a motion to approve the amendment.
Thank you very much. A motion by Gene and a second.
Michael Owens, a second.
Thank you, Michael. We're going to do this by roll call vote. So Margie, please call the roll.
Dave, just for clarification, the motion on the floor is to recommend adoption of amendment number one to the TPA's fiscal year 22 to 26 transportation improvement program as presented. Just remember to unmute your microphones by either hitting the button on the base or on your computer and say yes, no, or yay or nay when I call your name. Tracy Phelps?
Yes.
Brian Rosenzweig? I'm sorry, Bruce Rosenzweig?
Yes.
Kathleen Hatcher?
Yes.
Ted Goodenough?
Yes.
Joanna Peluso?
Yes.
Joanne Scaria is absent. Fadi Nassar?
Yes.
Sally Channon?
Yes.
David Willock?
Yes.
Jean Matthews?
Yes.
Yash Nagal? And I don't believe Yash has joined us, so he'll be marked as absent from the vote. Michael Owens?
Yes.
Christian Santa Gonzalez?
Yes.
John Roach?
Yes.
Stephanie Thoburn is absent. Brian Ruescher?
Yes.
It passes unanimously, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Margie. Now on to item B with the new items. Motion, the Vision Zero Action Plan update. Is Jessica Jocelyn available electronically, virtually? All right. Jessica, the floor is yours.
I am. Let me get my video started for you guys. All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you for having me here today to present the Vision Zero 2021 Action Plan update. If you go to the next slide, I really want to take a moment and pause and remind us of what Vision Zero is. This is a movement to eliminate all traffic fatalities and severe injuries. And here on the screen, we have a picture of a collision. And I'm sure when we all look at that, our stomachs all drop and we know how dangerous it can be on our facilities. This movement was started in 1997 out of Sweden. And Sweden has actually seen a 50% reduction in fatalities and serious injuries since this movement began in their country. In the United States, we're up to 49 cities that have also adopted and bought into this movement of trying to create a safer system. And then with the state of Florida, I know we have FDOT on the line, we have taken on the Target Zero movement, which is in the same vein, where we don't want to see and have folks dying anymore or being injured on our facilities. Moving to the next slide. You know, these reports that we do have a lot of data in them. And I think in our profession, being engineers and planners and other professionals, those numbers are numbers. And we need to remind ourselves there are names behind the numbers in this plan. So we implemented into this update references to those that have been lost and told their story to really make sure we're always putting first humans. There are people moving on our streets, and we just always have to keep that in the forefront of our mind. Next slide. So the TPA, for those that aren't aware, if you're newer to the committee, has been working towards this creating safer streets since probably honestly for their existence. But here we're going back to 2016 with their complete streets policy that you all adopted. Just recognizing and committing that we will create streets for everyone at the policy level that was formed in 2016. Then moving to 2017, the TPA adopted the Complete Streets Design Guidelines, where we tried to really advance from policy to a toolbox of how we can design our streets safer from an engineering standpoint. In 2018, the TPA adopted the zero fatalities policy. That then in 2019 moved into the first and original Vision Zero action plan that the TPA took on. I do want to applaud this group. We have exposure throughout the country to what folks are doing, and for an MPO to take on a Vision Zero action plan and recognize and commit to their role in the bigger picture of creating safe streets is a best practice. So I do applaud you all for taking this on. And then, of course, now in 2021, we are going back to that 2019 plan and updating it with new information and additional actions to ensure we're holding ourselves accountable to try and keep moving the needle to creating safer facilities. And the next slide. On this slide, we show the Vision Zero key principles. So I'm just going to read through them. There are 9 of them. Political commitment, developing an action plan, multidisciplinary leadership, community engagement, cooperation and collaboration, a systems-based approach, equity, data-driven, and transparent. So these 9 areas are the backbone and principles of what Vision Zero is all about. And the Vision Zero movement, as most of you, I'm sure, are aware, just recognize that it's not one agency, it's not one individual, it's not one mindset. It's all of these things need to come together if we truly are to achieve zero fatalities and serious injuries, or at a minimum, trend and head towards that direction. Next slide. So on this slide, there is data shown representing what we saw when we dug into the crash data. So I'll walk through what these graphics are indicating. So traffic fatalities are increasing. Unfortunately, I don't come with a good message. 2020 was the highest in years of fatalities. So in 2016, there were 181 deaths. 2017, it did go down to 164, 2018 back to 183, where it went up again. 2019, we saw it dip down to 174 deaths. And then, as I was saying, 2020, we're back up again at 185 people that have died last year. We do speculate because of COVID, there was faster speeds occurring on the roads because there was less congestion. But at the highest level, we just know it did increase. In the past 5 years, 887 people died on our roads in Palm Beach County, and 5,395 people were injured. I wanted, because of the context of your committee, I did want to share that 29% of the deaths were pedestrians and cyclists. And that's, you know, that's why we're here. That's why we have this committee. 77% of the pedestrians and bicyclists who died, it happened during nighttime. So that was something that was pretty powerful in the data in terms of where we can potentially concentrate more. So I don't want to come with this information, but I know you all are aware of these conditions and put your heart into what you do, especially on this committee. But just wanted to share some of the findings over the past 5 years. And if you go to the next slide, there's additional information related to our high injury network. So what we did here is we took the data, applied it onto Palm Beach County network, and did a statistical assessment and identified the top 50 or so corridors where fatalities, serious injuries, and also property damage only. And we did a weighting to determine where really we should start. Obviously, all roads in Palm Beach should be safe, but we have to start somewhere. So that's where we identified a high injury network. And on that high injury network, most at risk, of course, pedestrians and cyclists are involved. Most at risk also, we found older adults and traditionally underserved communities. In terms of critical crash factors, Fridays and weekends were floating to the top in terms of period during the week. And in terms of time of day, it was 7 to 10 p.m. Where critical crashes were occurring. And in terms of worst streets, you know, we have a large database where we can sort where the crashes were occurring. Samples of some of the worst streets is Glades Road, Boynton Beach Boulevard, and Okeechobee Boulevard. Military Trail, of course, popped up, US 1. So kind of the theme, which we know are the larger roads where people can travel more fast, are where we're seeing some of these severe and fatal crashes mostly occurring. And in the high injury network, 19% was pedestrian and bicycle fatalities and serious injuries. And going to the next slide. So now that we walk through the data, I do want to share that it was very important in this update that we had a very clear alignment with your strategic plan that the TPA has adopted and committed to. So the first element of the strategic plan that you all should be proud of accomplishing again is the actual Vision Zero action plan that the TPA is committed to and its update. Also, the interactive comment map that's been embedded onto the TPA website has been a helpful tool that folks can go to and share with you all in the TPA where there are issues and opportunities. Alyssa's done a great job and her team with the ped and bike safety field reviews, so those continue to occur. And again, having exposure to the country, I'd say that's the best practice that you really can move the needle forward in finding safety opportunities. Your project scoring has been updated to include specific and intentional safety components in the local initiatives and transportation alternative programs. And the state road modification program is also being updated to intentionally include safety components. And then of course, modification of the TPA committees that we have representation from different groups, and that safety is included within that. So moving to the next slide. So now that we walk through your strategic plan, so what do we want to highlight this in this update from a Vision Zero action plan perspective? So there are three categories that you would have seen in the backup. We have a policy category, a funding category, and a culture category. Across those three, there are 12 actions included in this update that I'm going to read through. So under the first category, policy, there are 5 actions. The first is to produce a Vision Zero annual report and proactively seek feedback and research latest Vision Zero best practices. The second action, and I am looking for feedback at the end of this and questions as I read through them, include safety changes in TPA legislation and policy positions. The third policy action is identify target speeds for high crash corridors based on context classification and safety. If you're wondering what target speed and context classification is, FDOT, you'll be getting a presentation following mine, but that's a really great movement that the DOT is taking to again, move the needle to create better facilities for everyone. The fourth action is to collaborate with partners, such as yourself, to create a consistent process for displaying the safety analysis included in TIP projects. So again, just being very intentional from the scoping of an analysis and project that it includes safety so that you all, when you're reported to on the alternatives and projects and such things like that, that you'll have information to make informed decisions from a safety standpoint. And then the last policy action, very important, is to work with the school district of Palm Beach County to require safe walking, biking, and driving curriculums. Those conversations continue to be had, and there's some momentum already we're seeing on the school district side partnering with the TPA. So those are the 5 under policy. If we move to the next slide, there are 2 actions related to the funding category. The first is work with signal maintaining agencies to make signalized intersection crossings more pedestrian friendly. The second one is to evaluate safety aspects of TPA-funded projects 1 year after construction completion. We haven't formally edited anything yet, but the previous committees were suggesting that we expand that even to a 5 year post construction potentially, just to make sure that the data is there in a good length of time to really see what's occurring from a safety perspective. And then the last category that I mentioned, the culture actions, there are five actions listed here. From a culture perspective, the first one being to provide reviews of fatal pedestrian and bicycle crash reports, including observations and potential actions. The second action for culture is to collaborate with roadway owners, so the local agencies and FDOT, to maintain a detailed data inventory to provide more effective analysis of complete streets opportunities. The third action is to implement a Vision Zero media and public education campaign. So working with Melissa and her team at the TPA and with the local agencies, really get the word out and go beyond engineering and really hit some different categories to see if we can move the needle that way. The fourth is to host an annual Vision Zero workshop for local communities and agencies. Again, the TPA really wants to be able to partner with you all and help in their purview from a Vision Zero and safety perspective. And then taking that a step further beyond a workshop with local agencies is to participate in Vision Zero safety events, as well as other local transportation safety events, and encourage those events to also be held in traditionally underserved communities. So I think there's a great opportunity with you all to partner and identify what events you may be having that the TPA could join and provide resources there to, again, get the word out of the Vision Zero movement. So those are the 12 actions. I do appreciate your time today letting me walk through this very important topic, and I look forward to receiving your feedback and comments from the Ped Bike and Trails group.
Thank you, Jessica. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Is there any discussion or a motion? And discussion can follow a motion. I see Jean raised her tint card.
Yeah, as part of this, were those accidents reports part of this Vision Zero? Because I read them and I was kind of shocked by how many people left the scene of an accident with a bike ped. And the other thing was, some of them were people were crossing a wide road and then were in the median and got hit. So that's like a structural improvement that can be made, but those accident reports were very telling. They were very disturbing.
Yes, at the Vision Zero level, we didn't get into each crash report because there were hundreds of thousands of crashes, but certainly the intent beyond Vision Zero would be to dive into the details of what's actually occurring on these facilities. So with this set of 12 actions, that would be a next step when you're identifying what to move forward with. But yeah, we review those crash reports and it's hard. It's hard to get through them. But I think it's that emotion that will make this successful and see us trend in the right direction, ideally.
Thank you. It looks like we have some hands raised.
I do. So Brian, in case you wanted to note it, I have Joanna, David, Fadi, and John.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you, Jessica, for the report. It was really just some critical data to share. And I'm specifically have some questions about the culture action items. Can you explain to me what a Vision Zero safety event is and like what would be like in that toolbox of events?
Yeah, and I don't know if Andrew is nearby or Cassidy. I know they were they wanted to commit to having events. So I know From my standpoint, it's more coming to events that the locals are having with a Vision Zero campaign, if you will. So the details of that toolbox is the next step, Joanna, that we would be working through. A standalone Vision Zero event as well could potentially be an option, which is part of that. But the details behind it haven't yet been ironed out. But if you all have ideas or feedback on that, we're all ears as well. But that's a good question. Good clarification.
And then just a follow up to that, I think, you know, obviously it's extremely important that it is targeted towards traditionally underserved communities. I would just push that a little bit further and you know, not just say that the events be held in traditionally underserved communities, but really promote that that multidisciplinary leadership and that community engagement in these events for the feedback. And the comments that you're hearing really get included and incorporated into a community's local Vision Zero plan. So that's the only change I personally would like to see in that section. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. That's a great observation. We don't want to make it sound like we're just gonna hold them there without the main intent is promoting that we create safer environments in those communities specifically. So thanks. Great observations.
Thank you. David.
Great presentation, Jessica. When I'm looking at this deaths and severe injuries map, it's alarming. I mean, well over 1,000 deaths on there, a whole bunch of fatalities on there. I'm wondering, I mean, I live in Boynton Beach, and it seems like just a few years ago, we used to have a lot of police presence, especially in areas that had lower speed limits, Old Boynton, for example. It seems like there is no police presence anymore. There was a big problem with people speeding in school zones. I think that made it to the news. Maybe a month ago, there was a kind of a crackdown in Boynton Beach. I think they handed out 200 tickets in one day or something like that. Is there any effort to maybe get funding for maybe overtime for some of the, you know, the local municipal police and also for the Palm Beach County Sheriff?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this actually came up in the other committees as well, wanting to bring law enforcement more into the Vision Zero Action Plan. To directly answer your question, I know if there is an opportunity for the TPA to play a role in getting funding, that certainly is something they're open to pursuing. And there's not a specific action in the plan though to do that. And quite a bit of coordination is going to need to occur with the local law enforcement agencies throughout Palm Beach County. I don't know if Alyssa or others, Andrew, if he's there, had anything more to add on the law enforcement side and helping get them funding. It's an important component for sure.
Andrew's going to approach and give us a quick response.
I'm going to just jump in. There's a lot of grants for law enforcement available for speed zones and schools and things like that. And I get those grants across my desk and I can certainly send them to the TPA.
Thank you. Thank you, Jean. Andrew.
Thank you. This is Andrew Euler, TPA. Yep. I mean, that's a tough one for us. I think we've struggled the most with is that there's already, as Jean said, and with these HVE grants, these high visibility enforcement grants, a lot of law enforcement go through those programs to get funding for enforcement. And so those are working pretty well and they're very data driven. So they have emphasis areas that they focus on. And so you have to be one of the top locations within the state for that emphasis area for you to get funding towards that. So, and then here in our county, it seems like the sheriff's office has been pretty good and the other law enforcement in our county have been pretty good about going after those grants. Here's a TPA, you know, we got to figure out what would be our role to assist in that even more. It seems like they already have the data-driven approach to it, working with the state. So I don't know if they need that assistance, but if there's other ways we can assist, we'd be happy to try to do that if we can do it within our means as a metropolitan planning organization. Some of those things we have in the plan for enforcement, I think at the beginning we have about the policies that we might try to focus on at the state and federal level. So you'll see things that are geared more towards like legislation. So we have automated speed enforcement in there. And there might be a few other ones related to enforcement. So those are like ways that we advocate, but we're always looking for more ideas about how to help these other safety partners in accomplishing their own work as well. But law enforcement and lack of enforcement has been a tough one. And if there's a way to solve it from a TPA to assist with that, we'd be open to that.
Have we ever approached PBSO offering them a seat maybe at BIDPAC or something?
I can respond to that as well, Chair. Is that okay? Yes, we actually, our strategic plan that was passed a couple months ago that you all reviewed as well has an action in there for fiscal year 2022 to reevaluate the structure of our committees to better align with our initiatives at the TPA. So one of those main initiatives we have is safety. So as we develop a new structure for our committees, we're looking into adding people such as law enforcement to our committees in that new structure.
Okay, thank you.
And that will happen this year, fiscal year 2022.
Thank you, David. Does that complete your comments?
Yes.
Thank you, Fadi.
Good presentation, Jessica. My question is, I think you mentioned about kind of before and after, kind of understanding what actions are taken and how effective they are. Now, you know, we know that fatal crashes, there's a lot of random aspect to them. It's not like when you're dealing with a high concentration of crashes that you can come up and figure out exactly what the patterns are and what the cause is. I'm just like to, you know, get your ideas, how you're planning to understand how to evaluate the actions taken in whatever recommendation you come up with.
Yeah, I can give my professional opinion. I haven't walked through with the TPA yet on the exact protocol for before after studies. But certainly make a good point that we don't know until we dive into the details if there are any trends or if they're random occurrences. But the idea is to using the high injury network, the high level data assessment, just start going out and seeing what is occurring in more detail and try to identify solutions. I know Alyssa, your group already was doing the audits, have made some recommendations just going out there. So although, you know, there may not be a silver bullet solution for 40 of the core, 40 of the 50 high injury network corridors, I think even going one by one, you know, maybe a backplate's missing on a signal or the striping is worn down, you know, things we're finding that are low hanging fruit. Just from doing audits and going out, and we can track the performance over time. In terms of larger scale improvements, you know, you can go different ways, and it depends on the agency too. I know there is a desire to continue to partner with the county. Melissa yesterday had brought that up a few times, that the county too, of course, is committed to safety. So as we're going through that before after process, if there are suggestions or ideas the county too wants to pull in, I know from my standpoint, working with Andrew, we lead the San Francisco before after evaluation program, and there's lots of lessons learned that I'm happy to share with the TPA as well. But sorry, I don't have a direct answer for you, but I do agree with your observation, and I think we just need to just start and get out there and continue doing the before after and see what we find and share that information with each other so that we all can get more information to help us do our job better. Okay, ideally.
Thank you. Looks like Andrew wants to make another point.
Yes, thank you. I can build off of what Jessica is saying. Fadi, that's a good question. And I think it might have been what Jessica mentioned about San Francisco. A good example from there is they sort of have a toolbox of things that they can evaluate for before and after. So, you know, as Jean mentioned earlier about the video we had, you know, when you can see the before and after of traffic crashes, that's readily available data. That one's one that can be pulled pretty easily, right? Other ones that would be considered to really be case by case on the type of project. So for example, if it has to do with traffic calming, you know, something that the county is probably already very familiar with before and after studies of speeds through corridors, before and then after when you put the treatments in. So that's another one. Other things from the toolbox that I think would be appealing would be how well that people obey and provide the right of way for pedestrians crossing in a new crosswalk. It's like how well do they yield for before and afterward, after when you put in like an RRFB. So there's a bunch of things like that which are safety related that could be data that we get from the field that we'll be looking into. And so I think this toolkit that we saw from San Francisco is a good place to start because they had a bunch of different sort of objectives they had with the projects, and then how do you measure those objectives specifically?
Thank you. Fadi, I'm guessing that completes your comments.
Yes, thank you.
John Roach, thank you, Fadi.
Good morning. First, I want to commend TPA's, your staff, and your consultant. I think you may have hired a consultant to do the work on this as well, but I thought the report was very well put together, very informative, definitely concerning in some ways. Towards the beginning, you were talking about the trend over the last 5 years and how 2020 has been the highest of those 5 years. And I agree that that's concerning and unfortunate. So I'm curious if you've looked at why was 2017 substantially lower? You know, what was it about that year that resulted in fewer numbers? But also for the 2020 numbers, was it, you talked about COVID and, you know, the change in congestion, you know, maybe a cause in that, and therefore higher speeds and higher fatalities. Did the change in percentage of vehicular versus pedestrian versus bicyclists and so forth change, or was that consistent? I was just curious if 2020 had a higher number of pedestrian fatalities because fewer people were out driving and so forth. I have some other comments, so if you want to respond to that one first.
I have the report up in front of me. I do, John, want to get that in a tabular format and send that to you. So I don't have a direct answer right now, but I will follow up with Margie and Andrew on getting that table put together for the trend of the ped bike.
Okay. And then just a technical comment on page 9 of your report, you talked about the total number of fatalities based upon modes of transportation. I think it was brought up at the technical advisory committee the other day. Just clarify that was a 5-year trend, not an individual year. It seemed like all your other numbers, you did clarify, you know, what the time frame was, just so it was evident. And then to kind of touch on what Joanna was talking about with regards to the underserved communities, one of your action items was working with the school district, and I would certainly encourage you to include community centers as part of that. You know, a lot of the underserved communities, you know, those children utilize their community centers, and that's another way to tap that population. So, you know, rather that's part of your event action item, or rather it's part of that action item of working with school district. Obviously, community centers are usually run by the municipalities. I know in West Palm, we have quite a few in our underserved communities, and, you know, they get utilized quite a bit. So I think that's another opportunity in which to educate those children and, you know, their families as part of your outreach. With the school district one, again, I think it came up at the TAC meeting, was even at the high school level, not only are you dealing with vehicular aspects, but also the pedestrian and bicyclists as part of that. So, you know, I wouldn't want you to exclude that educational opportunity just because it's a higher level or older population. So.
Thank you, John. Those are great observations, and the community centers, I don't know if that's come up yet, so really appreciate you mentioning that. That's a very good point.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who's wishing to speak, Margie?
Yes, I have Michael Owens.
Thank you, Michael. For yours. Thank you, Margie.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Good morning, Jessica. Thank you for the presentation. And excuse the vacuum in the back. We're at work here.
No problem.
Just a quick question. You mentioned there were three roadways, three arterials that I guess were the most egregious with regards to, I guess, fatalities and other statistics. It was Boynton Beach Boulevard, Okeechobee, and Glades Road, I believe.
Yeah, that was a sampling of what some of the worst roads were.
Gotcha.
The type of road. Yeah.
Okay. My thing is, was it the arterial as a whole, or were there some segments of that or those arterials that were far worse than others? And was there a breakdown of those segments? I was just curious if there were statistics taken between certain areas.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have a huge database in Excel that does break down segment by segment. And the way we did our segmentation was using the count station IDs. So we tried to use a data set that already broke down all the roadways associated with volume counts, and then attach the safety information to those segments. So the segments are not consistent in length, so it's not like every mile you have a break, but the segments are quite short on the shorter side that we worked with. And in the database, you'll see some of the segments, you do have consecutive segments that are popping up, creating a corridor, which is what you will see on our high injury network map. So in short, it's not the entire road that is necessarily on the high injury network, but there certainly are instances and many instances where you end up getting a good chunk of the roadway on the high injury network because each of those segments are popping up as having high fatality and serious injury occurrences. And I know Andrew's group is happy to share any information, and the intent is to share information with folks such as yourself to see what we can do together to address some of these issues.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'd like to see that, if you know, just I'm wonky that way. But yeah, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I get it. Going into the detail, you know, that's what we want to see, how we can help.
Thank you.
Yeah, good question.
Thank you. If there are no other comments, I'd just like to make you.
I'm sorry. I do have Joanna that raised her hand again.
All right, Joanna.
Sorry, Brian. I just have one quick question. So you did mention at the beginning of the presentation about most of the crashes happening at nighttime. So I was curious in the action plan if there's any particular items that you would pull out that would be specifically addressing the issues at nighttime, or if there's conversation about adding a specific action item related to that.
Yeah, I know for the ped bike audit, as part of that, lighting would be pulled into those in terms of observing when you go out there how the lighting is. The previous action plan did have a specific action on lighting, and I know at least FDOT continues to do quite a bit of work on lighting, but I don't know if Andrew has any additional items. Sorry, Andrew, I can't see where he is. But I do know lighting continues to be on the, I don't want to call it a checklist, but you know, the checklist of things to be looking at whenever we go out into the field and dig more into the data.
Sure. If I could just mention one thing quick, we did a walk audit on the Indiantown corridor with the TPA team. But there's conditions to not go out at night to capture those things. So we did that. Healthier Jupiter took that on as an activity to contribute to the audit. So that's something important, I think, like with community-based partners. If the TPA can't do nighttime walk audits, like who's the partner that's going to be taking that on?
Yeah, that's true. Because right now you can look during the day, but you're not doing a full-blown lighting measurement analysis. Yeah.
And Jessica, if I could just chime in before Andrew, if he has to respond to any comments. When we did our walk audit in the city of Delray Beach, I went out before everyone and I borrowed a photometric reader and took some measurements. I mean, it was pretty easy to see that, you know, kids were already walking on the corridor when it was still dusk and dawn or pre-light hours. And observed, you know, some crossing conditions where you could barely see the children. So, I mean, simply going out and measuring, and if you have the school district there and you can get them to agree to participate and share photos as well of those activities ongoing, that's very powerful. We also include lighting in all of our TPA projects when we submit them for consideration with LI and whatnot. So I think that might have answered the question. If Andrew's walking away from the microphone, so I'm assuming he says yes.
That's helpful.
Any hands raised? If not, I'll make my final comments. Ask for a motion. So I kind of agree with, I think it was David who mentioned the map is scary, and others who have said that the crashes are random. But at the same time, I also have a strong sentiment and the feeling that if you look at that map and you say, where are crashes able to happen? The answer is yes. And that's simply because of our roadway design. I know that there are contributing factors absolutely that are there, such as lighting, wet conditions, et cetera. But the overall and overarching theme is speed and roadway design. Another theme that's been commented on extensively by the committee is with regards to law enforcement. And I would really like for Jessica maybe to and the TPA to go and pull the high visibility enforcement grants that have been allocated in Palm Beach County to see how much money has been put into high visibility enforcement, simply just as a metric for this study, because police cannot be everywhere. If you look at the map and you look at where those high visibility enforcement campaigns have been deployed, I think it would be unreasonable to have the expectation that law enforcement would be there with respect to having a measurable effect. I also shared with Alyssa and Andrew a study which showed that police presence doesn't actually decrease fatalities on roadways where high crashes are occurring. So I'd ask that you please share that with the staff. I know that law enforcement is good to have with respect to part of the conversation, but the conversation can't rely on one entity purely. It has to come back to roadway design. And I think that's a really important element to look at with respect to the overall plan. And I would love to see the report kind of reflect the high visibility efforts that have been going on by law enforcement and to see some of the vanity that might be there with respect to law enforcement, because even if we pay overtime to those police officers to go out and measure, frankly, it won't be enough. You cannot have a police presence enough to really deter the crashes that are occurring. It really comes down to roadway design. So with that in mind, is there a motion for this item?
Jean Matthews, I make a motion to recommend adoption of the Vision Zero Action Plan update.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Michael Owens, I second it.
Thank you. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, Margie, please call the roll.
Just to clarify for everybody, because this did come up in our other committees, the motion is to recommend adoption of the Vision Zero Action Plan update with the comments that you all have provided today. Our staff will do our best to incorporate everything, but they will also reach out for any items that need further discussion. So as a reminder, please unmute your microphones when I call your name and either state yes, no, or yay or nay. Tracy Phelps?
Yes.
Bruce Rosenzweig?
Yes.
Kathleen Hatcher?
Yes.
Ted Goodenough?
Yes.
Joanna Peluso?
Yes.
Joanne Scaria is absent. Fadi Nassar?
Yes.
Sally Channon?
Yes.
David Willa?
Yes.
Jean Matthews?
Yes.
Yash Nagal is absent. Michael Owens?
Yes.
Christian Santa Gonzalez?
Yes.
John Roach?
Yes.
Stephanie Thoburn is absent. Brian Ruscher?
Yes.
It passes unanimously, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Margie. I believe now we're on to information items. 3A, update to the FDOT design manual to implement target speeds. I'll be welcoming Mr. Dwayne Carver, FDOT Complete Streets Program Manager, to present this item. Thank you, Dwayne. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
It's been interesting listening to your discussion about Complete Streets and the efforts that you have there. What we're wanting to talk with you about this morning, I'm Dwayne Carver with Central Office in Tallahassee, and also presenting with me this morning will be Scott Peterson, who is with District 4 DOT. And we're going to talk about our latest effort to try to help move the needle on safety for complete streets. It's something called Target Speed. And we've released a bulletin, an RDB, a roadway design bulletin, to require that we consider target speed when we select a design speed for our projects. And I'll talk a little more about that and what that kind of means from a statewide level. And then Scott's going to go into more of how this will be implemented within your district there. Right screen. There we go. This is brought to you also by the Vital Few. This is a safety effort that the department is doing in support of our Target Zero effort, which is DOT's version of Vision Zero. And what we recognize is that there's three areas that really kind of bubble to the top where we're having issues with safety on our state roadway system: bike ped safety, intersection safety, and lane departure safety. And managing the speeds on our roadways can actually help all three of these. And so all three of these efforts are actually being supported by this move to target speed. So the reason we have this target speed is, you may recall back in 2018, the department went to a context classification system based design program for our state roadway system. And the FDOT design manual incorporates this, and it's kind of built around this. And so you have these six context classifications. And within each of these context classifications, there's now a range of design speeds that can be used. And the design speed is very important because it sets a whole lot of other things that can happen on the project. So if you want to know things like, can I or can I not have on-street parking? What kind of bicycle facility should I have? How close can the street trees be to the roadway? Can I even get street trees in there? All kinds of things are going to be set in part by the design speed, in a large part by the design speed. And so knowing that design speed and being able to use the right one is going to be very important. But what you can see here is that there's quite a wide range of design speeds. If you look, for instance, in the C3 suburban context classification, there's a 20 mile an hour range of design speeds. In the C4, which is our general urban condition, there's a 15 mile an hour range of design speeds. And so while we were very happy to have the ability to design and maintain these lower speeds in these context classifications, prior to this, our lowest speed was 45 miles an hour. We realized that there was not a lot of guidance to how to get us there. And so that's what this target speed is designed to do. What it does is it requires and recognizes that you have this interdisciplinary effort to have a discussion about what this target speed should be, which is going to then guide you toward one end of this design speed range or the other based on what the desired operating speed is of the roadway. That's the target speed. And it says that in any project where we're going to have a design speed, not all projects have a design speed associated with them, but most do. And where they do, you have to set a target speed first, and then you work into that design speed. And it provides a little bit of guidance about how exactly you would set that target speed, although there's more guidance that's provided in our context classification guide, and there will be even more in the new version of that will be released in January 2022 to support this new bulletin and changes to the FDM. And finally, it recognizes in the bulletin that the district continues to make the final decision on how design speed is set and what that final speed is going to be. However, there is an opportunity, and a very important opportunity, in fact, for local involvement in that discussion. So I'll kind of show you a little bit about what that looks like. And so what I'm going to show you next is just kind of the process that you go through, or that we're recommending districts go through based on the experience in some of the districts that have been doing this for a little while now. To set this target speed, it's not so simple as you just pull a lever and a target speed pops out the back end of the thing. there's actually quite a bit of discussion that has to go on in that. When does that discussion start? Well, if you have a project with a planning phase that's going through PD&E, you can start right then talking about what the target speed might be on this roadway when you're finished with it. And as you go through that process, you should arrive at the end at what a speed would be. A lot of our projects don't have a planning phase. 3R projects, for instance, just kind of happen based on what's happening with the pavement conditions, which means that the planning sort of has to be done ahead of time just based on the general conditions of the roadway and the area around it. And so we don't have a specific planning phase. But even in those situations, there is an initial point when you can set a target speed, or at least an initial target speed that might then be modified as you go along. But let's say we do a project either through PD&E or we have a 3R project. The folks who are going to know what that target speed might be are the folks who are going to be looking at the context classification. That's your complete streets coordinator, folks like that, your bike ped coordinator. Clearly the DDEs, the district design engineers and traffic operations engineers, safety administrators, and your MPO liaisons are all going to have an idea perhaps what the target speed should be. So you can begin thinking about it there. Then as we get into setting the design controls for the project, we start looking at, well, what do we think we could really design that could achieve that target speed? That might change it a bit. And let's say we can get to a point where we all agree that we could achieve a particular target speed by making a bunch of changes to the roadway. Well, then it has to go through scoping and budget. And in scoping and budget, things may have to change. You may discover, for instance, that you don't have enough money to do all the things you wanted to do. And so then it's a question of, well, can we find that money, or do we have to scale back what we thought we could do in order to make it fit and make it work? Then it goes through the work program to make sure it's all there and that we can actually get the money that we thought we were going to have. And then finally, we can design the thing based on what we can afford and what we thought we could build. And then we build it and we see how well it worked. And so you can see there's a lot of steps that go through there. So I want to make sure it was clear that there's some complexity to how this target speed would be achieved. But the really great thing is that we're even talking about having a target speed and starting with this initial notion of that we wouldn't just accept the old design speed of the roadway as what we had to go forward with. We actually have an opportunity now to talk about changing that and see how we could change it. And Scott will go into more detail about how that would work in your district. But just to recap very quickly then, kind of the process that we go through, you know, you start with a context classification for the state roadway that gives you a range of speeds. And then we would go within that range and pick a target speed that gives us a appropriate design speed for the project itself. Our FDM 202 chapter provides some tools to achieve that target speed, but it doesn't have any money in there. It's just got tools. So then you have to decide, well, what can we actually achieve based on what we have? And so the final target speed and design speed will match each other, but that's going to be based on the balancing, the context, the classification, the project needs, and what resources we have. So the district has to make that final decision, but the locals play a critical role in that by helping set what the current context classification is, and also, more importantly, even what the future classification is going to be. That's almost entirely controlled by the local government based on the decisions that you make, and then the department sort of responds to that based on what we're seeing. If your continued development pattern is for, you know, C3 suburban development, you'll get one kind of answer. If you're going to urbanize and create more transportation network, you could perhaps get a different kind of answer in terms of what the future classification might be. But your vision and needs for the project area are going to help us set that initial target speed. And in some cases, it may also, the locals may also assist with funding. So it may be that there's something that we all recognize should be done or could be done on a project, but cannot be done on a 3R project because we have a limited amount of money for those. If we can partner with our local folks, then maybe we can make something better happen on that project by working together on that. So that's about as deep as I can get into it from a statewide level. So I'm going to turn it over now to Scott, and he's going to talk about kind of how this is, that will probably play out in District 4. So Scott, I'm here. I'll run your slides for you. Just let me know when you want to advance.
Great. Thanks, Dwayne. Dwayne actually gave a pretty good comprehensive overview, so I'll probably just touch on a couple of the points he made again. So one of the questions is, when will this target speed be determined? Well, it's got to be done very early, like at the time of the original project identification, scoping, because as Dwayne mentioned, it may affect the scope. If we, in fact, decide a lower target speed is warranted, that might affect certain things we want to build on the roadway, you know, curb bulb outs, mid-block crossings, I mean, a variety of things. So if it affects the scope, we want to know that early to make sure it gets funded and programmed appropriately. So the design bulletin went into effect immediately for all projects prior to phase one, which is essentially pretty early in design. So there's a whole bunch of projects that are already past the scoping and programming phase, but are already in design. So we are going to go ahead and immediately implement this on those projects that are already in design by having the design teams take a look at those and make recommendations to this multidisciplinary team that Dwayne mentioned. So this will begin to be put into effect immediately, starting in projects in design. Dwayne, next slide. So some of the factors, again, Dwayne mentioned a lot of these. The second bullet on there is probably of great interest to most of you, local input. Local input is definitely one of the factors. It's an important factor, but it's not a factor. You know, together we will make the appropriate decision based on, you know, some of these other factors, speed, bike ped usage. I think what one of the things that's important to note here is it's not the district's intention to use this as a way just to reduce every speed on all our state roads because slower is safer. It's a tool that allows us to make the right decision for the right location. In some cases, slower is safer. But, you know, if you have a State Road 60 or a State Road 80, you know, out west, well, not too far out west, but in the transitional area, you know, maybe that is the appropriate speed. You know, people are trying to get from West Palm out to Belgrade. I don't want to get too into specifics because it's not like I've looked at that one, but it's the right speed for the right area. And we will be looking to our local partners to help us make that decision. And next slide. So if the question comes up, okay, so you've decided a lower speed is appropriate. What are you going to do about it? And this gets into how this could affect the project scope. And listed here are just a few bullets. There's a much more comprehensive list on the reference points I give to the right there on FloridaCompleteStreets.com and the FDM chapter. And again, I want to emphasize the point. The use of this target speed did not just allow unlimited budget and scope on every project. If we have a triple R project, there's still probably certain limitations of what we're going to be able to fund with that project. But we might start getting there. If a lower target speed is warranted, maybe we can do some things with a triple R project. But if the TPA would like more dramatic changes, you know, they're certainly free to program a project and we could pursue that together. So we will be attempting to put design elements in place that will help encourage lower speeds if we decide that a lower speed is warranted. And I believe that is my last slide.
Thank you. I'd be glad to take it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the presentation. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Any committee members have comments?
Are there any hands raised? I do have Fadi with his hand raised so far.
Thank you. Fadi, the floor is yours.
Yes. You know, this is kind of very important topic. I mean, from the county perspective, we get requests all the time that to lower the speed. And I understand and appreciate what the DOT is doing, but the DOT is very careful in saying, you know, you don't just select the speed. I mean, it has to be based on some kind of criteria. And if a certain area, you need to change the speed, some physical or some really actual improvement need to be done to make that road, you know, appropriate for whatever speed you design it. Just a recent example, there is a road that's part of it is county, part of it is in the city of Boca. It's Camino Real. There was a serious accident happened over there and we were asked to look at it. So that segment is about, I would say 4 miles, 1.5 miles is a county, 2.5 miles is a city. Our posted speed is 45 miles an hour. The city posted speed is 30 miles an hour. So you would expect that the section within the city would be safer, but it's not. You know, we did 85 percentile speed on our segment. People drive, the 85 percentile is 47 miles an hour. On the city segment, which is posted at 30 miles an hour, the 85th percentile is also 47 miles an hour. We did it at 3 different locations. They're all 47 or 48 miles per hour. You know, I just looked through Signal 4 analytic. In our segment, we had 35 crashes in the past 3 years. In the city segment, there was 90 crashes. So I want to go back to what the manual of the DOT said, you know, setting the speed. Let me see if I can just read it. It says generally a higher number of crashes occur when the speed differential is greatest. Individual speed at the 85th percentile level are by definition the safest speed for travel. You know, on our segment, 20% of the driver go over the posted speed. On the city segment, it's between 87 and 92%. So I just want to ask you, where would you feel more safer to drive? On a road that's posted 30 miles an hour where 80% of the people drive faster? So it's a bigger question. I appreciate the DOT effort, but I think the DOT is very careful in saying you just don't go ahead and change the posted speed. It needs to be based on some actual effort to make the road driven at whatever speed you desire. That's my comment.
If I could just respond to that briefly, I am very familiar with that road, and the city and the county sections are dramatically different in development. And I think it underscores the point of you can't just lower the posted speed. You have to have design elements in place to make. Now, I would say that the city street does feel like a slower, and it is unfortunate that more people are speeding there. So maybe not enough design elements were done. And if all else fails, enforcement needs to be stepped up.
Yeah, I had sent to staff prior to these presentations. There's a link that you can go to for our design symposium webinars. We did one last month on speed management, and it goes into greater detail on how you change the design of a roadway to match a particular speed and the process that DOT is using that, because you can't simply re-sign the roadway with a different speed limit. You've got to change the design of the roadway itself. A lot of our issues are not, they're speed related, but they're not speeding related. It's the fact that the roadway it's operating the way it was designed. It was designed at a certain speed and people are driving that speed. It's just that speed is no longer the safe speed for the way that the area around the roadway has developed. And so what our speed management program is trying to do is let us basically retrofit roads to the extent we can to allow them to match more closely the development that's occurred around them. So if I had a road that was originally designed at 45 and you're driving it at 45, that may be fine in some places. Scott was giving some examples, but in other places, that's no longer a safe speed. So how do we change that? And you can't change it without really changing the design of the roadway itself. And so Fadi, I agree with you completely. It's really important to look at everything, not just the speed limit in the 85th percentile, but really looking at how the design of the roadway has to be modified.
You know,
that's what our manual's designed.
Yeah. When I want to add one point. Usually whenever we do a speed study, we get a full speed distribution for every hour of the day. And typically we do it for a day or for 3 days if we want to capture the weekend. Now, whenever we do that, we summarize the data and we send it to our contact person at the sheriff's office, telling them, listen, between 8 and 9 is your most effective hours to enforce that road. And I know, you know, when you mentioned about, Jessica mentioned about the high visibility enforcement, it seems like it's only targeted for pedestrian and for bicycle. It'd be nice to have a program, since in our case, we identify the hours of higher, you know, the higher speed that driven on that road. It'd be nice to have a program that identify budget fund for the police. So they know, for example, from 9 to 10 in the evening, you have, you know, very high people driving at a high speed. They can target that. It's a target enforcement. It's much more efficient use of their resources when we can tell them exactly what time are the most efficient. But by limiting this high visibility enforcement fund to pedestrian and bicycle, I think it won't allow us to kind of work with them on these particular hours.
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do at the department is take a pretty holistic view at speed management. And you might think of it, it's kind of occurring maybe in sort of 3 or 4 steps. You know, if we can think of it at the first level, is when we design the road, when the road is actually designed, if it's designed at the speed that we need it to be designed at, and that may involve changing the design speed, which is why this bulletin is so important. To allow us to do that, then in my world, looking at it from a design perspective, then that should fix it. We should design it right and it should work at that speed and we shouldn't have to do anything else to it. But there's another level that we can go to where we can use operations interventions and you know, we can do things with the signalization. And there's a lot of different operations and interventions we can do with signing and marking and speed feedback signs and all kinds of things. So maybe we can't fix it all with design. Maybe we can throw operations at it as well and try to get those techniques in there and make it work. And hopefully that'll fix the problem. But if that doesn't fix the problem, then maybe we have to work. We do have to then rely on law enforcement. But you see, rather than going directly to law enforcement to fix all the speeding problems, we want to, you know, see what other steps we can do before we get there, and really rely on the law enforcement as kind of a last measure. If you're having to do a lot of enforcement, to me, it tells me that we, you know, need to do more on design and more on operations to try to fix those problems as best we can. Of course, there's also education, you know, educating motorists to pay attention when they're driving and all the things they have to do. So there's a lot of steps that go into it. But I think at the department, we're trying to look at it more holistically than just thinking about going right to the enforcement end of it. Can we design it better and slower or to match the speed we need? And can we operate it that way? And then we get into enforcement and operations if we have to at that end. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other hands raised?
I do not see any, Chair.
Oh. Sorry. Tracy?
Just in reference to the Camino Gardens Road that was brought up, we get constant complaints from residents in that area, or we don't, or the police department does. I'd say easily 40, 50 a year, and the police department's response is to forward call directly to the traffic management center in Boca. They do nothing about it. They have no interest in enforcing the speed limit because they just transfer the call right to traffic engineering. And that's a problem. That's why the police should be involved in a lot of the things we talk, the decisions like that we are talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just add, I mean, I did call the police, department in Boca, just to share with them the hours we found that are the most effective to enforce, they transfer us to the city. So let's go.
Well, I just to round out the comments, and thank you, Scott and Dwayne, I really appreciate you coming. I really also appreciate the effort being put into looking at the design of current projects in District 4, Scott. So I appreciate you enlightening us with that respect to that. As I mentioned before, you know, we can design a roadway or we can post a speed limit differently, but having to lean perpetually on police officers to go out and enforce when more people are moving to Florida, you know, it will be a perpetual education and enforcement campaign. One design really should be the first and foremost effort. So I appreciate you all coming in and giving us that presentation and this update and this bulletin. It's much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Where are we? So we are now on items 3B. Andrew Euler, you're going to give us a presentation on the quarterly fatal crash analysis. Thank you, sir.
Hello again, everyone. Okay, I'm going to give our first update. It's a quarterly update, but this is the first half of 2021. And this covers the pedestrian bicycle quarterly fatal crash analysis. And so what this is a single page summary of each crash, fatal pedestrian bicycle crash within our county. And we're trying to provide a quick turnaround time on these quarterly when they come out to showcase to all the committees. And so this will be a reoccurring item on our agendas every quarter that we would like to refine moving forward. So why are we doing these? Really, this is to implement a TPA board direction we have. The action plan that you just recommended for approval included this as an action under that as well. And then why are we focusing specifically on these? Well, pedestrian bicycle crashes, as you all know, represent a disproportionate percentage of the fatalities. So around 27%, a quarter of our fatalities are pedestrian bicycle related, even though they don't make up that much of the users of our transportation network out there. Their mode split is much lower than that. So what really these are, though, is to promote discussion and a sense of urgency. So what you'll see in these reports, really, you know, it's a quick turnaround time from getting these reports from the statewide database and then downloading them and then doing our internal staff and consultant review and given to the stakeholders. It's really a higher level analysis. But really what we're trying to do here is promote discussion, keep that sense of urgency. And if there are some revealing trends and some high impact countermeasures we can really focus on, we'll go forward with those and evaluate them even more for those specific locations to see if there's anything we can take action on. So a summary for the first half of 2021, there's a map on the right side of the screen where there's predominantly located crashes. We have a total of 4 fatal bicycle crashes and 29 fatal pedestrian crashes. Many of these are clustered around arterial roadways that have commercial developments and activities along them that result in higher pedestrian activity. So those include places like Military Trail or Okeechobee Boulevard. So we're seeing high clusters in there, which is in line with what we've seen in historic trends in our county. What we were presenting in the Vision Zero Action Report that covered 5 years. What we also saw in the data for the first half of 2021 was that 3 of these occurred on January 1 after midnight. So within a matter of, I think it was about 3 or 4 hours, we had 3 fatal crashes. So that was a focus we wanted to mention in our presentation today, that one day alone accounted for 3 of those. And you'll see that also for July 4th, we got a few of those results, but we're not showing those today, but we'll show that in the next quarterly report that we saw some crashes on July 4th as well. So there are higher numbers on those holidays. And the last point I wanted to mention about the summary for the first half of 2021 for these pedestrian bicycle fatalities is that 25 occurred at dark. So the majority of the overwhelming majority of these occurred at dark, according to the police reports. But our consultant wanted to mention to us with these that 16 of those locations that were identified of the 25 identified lighting on the corridor. But our consultant wanted to mention that even though it says lighting in the police report, that's not really a great way of understanding the lighting conditions out there. So as Joanna mentioned before about doing a walking out at night, you really need to go out and assess these corridors to see how the lighting is out there at night, because roadway lighting is different than pedestrian scale lighting. And so it may be a different type of lighting that's needed, or where it's reported overall is not the issue of where the person was crossing. So it really takes a more in detailed evaluation of the corridor instead of just showing it as dark and lit or dark and unlit. So the next steps for this process, as I mentioned, we'll be coming here quarterly with these. We'd like to incorporate more feedback from committees and stakeholders when it's appropriate for this to refine this process. We're trying to refine the review process as well. So getting it to the local jurisdictions that these crashes occur in and getting their feedback in a timely manner. And then hopefully we continue to push this process and refine our countermeasures and then work with stakeholders to implement the refined countermeasures where we see it is appropriate. And that's all I have for you today. If you have any questions or if you want, I know there's a lot in your backup. So if you have any comments afterwards, just you can email me and we can have our staff fix those. And we wanna make these something that's effective and meaningful for our committees.
Thank you, Andrew. Staff, are there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you. Any hands raised?
I do not see any hands raised.
I see Jean. Jean, you're recognized.
I want to commend TPA staff for doing this. It must be rather traumatic to go through all these reports, really emotionally traumatic. Is there any speculation on why so many accidents, people just left the scene? I can't imagine.
That was striking too. I think when you read through these reports, as you're mentioning, Jean, it sort of like weighs on you over time. It's like, man, you see all these things that keep reoccurring. What was interesting in this was that we saw a lot of people leaving the scene of accidents or crashes. I would say what I speculate for that is, I haven't looked at the data on this, would be, I guess maybe a couple scenarios would be lack of insurance, right? Would be an issue. That's probably why they want to flee the scene. I can't make any assumptions on people who are like illegally, but if they don't have a citizenship or there's that one, or if you have an issue with prior history of issues, so not being able to actually drive legally. So those would be the ones. My guess would be insurance being a bigger one, but and then also there's the case of just people, in that situation, in a heightened state of emotion. So, but I don't have any statistics to back those all up.
Thank you, Jean. Any other hands raised?
No.
To follow up on Jean's comments, when you look at those crash reports, it would be interesting to see how many of the victims who were involved in a hit and run crash were placed at fault in that instance as well, just to see if that would be anything that we could track, or if the report, I know the reports don't always give you the full detail. And then the other is, I would like to know somehow what design manual these jurisdictions are responsible for. So if it's FDM or if it's Green Book. So, I mean, if it's a local jurisdiction or state jurisdiction, so that we can start looking at funding programs. That would be my only two ask. That might help to maybe move the needle on some of these things as you present them to the board.
Thank you. And I have one follow-up for you there too about the hit and runs. It was interesting that some of these were not considered at fault of the person driving, and they still did a hit and run. So that's an interesting one to me, that they're leaving the scene even though they're it seemed to be a clear case that they weren't at fault, I guess, from a legal standpoint possibly, but they were still running. So
right. Yeah, that was the instance in Delray Beach for the bicyclist crash that occurred. And Alyssa, I think you wanted to say something. Oh, sorry. Sally, you're recognized.
I think he covered it in his comments. It was surprising to me the number of cases where, I mean, people are just crossing the road without any crossing or darting in front, and considering that person is dead or was dead not too long after, and the vehicle fled the scene, then I'm figuring that is an assumption on the part of the investigator based on where the body was, or because some case they indicate that a witness said this, that, but in other cases it just appears that what they had was a body.
Right.
So a number of these do say the pedestrian darted or dashed or was in the road where they shouldn't be in the road, but the vehicle fled. So assume that's a deduction.
Okay. Any final comments on this before we go to our administrative items? Thank you, Mr. Euler. Appreciate it. Items 4A and 4B are for informational purposes only. There are no staff presentations unless requested by a committee member. Does anybody have any requests for 4A and 4B governing board summary points or DOT scheduling report? Seeing none, hearing none. Staff, are there any public comments on these items for 4A or 4B?
No, Mr. Vice Chair.
Okay, thank you. If I'm not mistaken, then we can just announce our next meeting date and we can head out. So our next meeting is going to be held October 7th, 2021. At this time, our committee meeting is adjourned. Thank you, TPA staff. We appreciate your participation. Thank you to all of those who are still with us on the phone. Meeting is adjourned at 10:49.
Take care, everyone.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.